Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Brexit means Brexit.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
Hello and welcome. I'm Royfield Brown, who is in a forever sunny California. And today we have a special guest with us, a good friend of mine, an old mucker of mine, Errol Murray, who has done something quite extraordinary a couple of years ago. He went to Ukraine and he trained Ukrainian media in how to use their phones as a tool to document and to report the goings on of Ukraine. And I think we've all seen the stunning results of the work that people like Errol have actually done in terms of training these new cadre of journalists, because one of the most stunning things for me is how the Ukrainian army, the Ukrainian government, the Ukrainian people, and of course its media have been using their phones as a weapon, not only to document the war, but also to use it as an effective tool for propaganda, to be out there on the spot. But first, Errol Murray, you have to tell us a little bit something about you. Tell us about your media background and before we find you in Ukraine a couple of years ago.
Well, first of all, thanks very much, Royfield, for bringing me into this group. It's amazing. I'm very excited about how this works. I was a journalist in print in the 90s and moved into social media in the noughties, in the early noughties, at a time when there wasn't a real social media. People were still thinking, what's an email address at that time? And I moved into, from social media, I moved into radio and complained all the time because my colleagues at the BBC in London, which is the national broadcaster in the UK, radio always got the short shrift and TV got all the money and all the funding. So I said, let's get some more money into radio. And they said, nope, but you can have a go at TV. And I was trained to be a video journalist, which allowed me to use my radio background, my social media background, and find a way to record, report, reflect on all platforms in the media.
I know that you are someone who's really well regarded in terms of what you do, and you've done a lot of training. Tell us about getting that call to go to Ukraine to train. Were you even exactly aware of where Ukraine was on the map?
Absolutely not. It wasn't somewhere that I was aware of. It wasn't somewhere that I'd thought about. I was working, I'd been filming and training internationally beforehand, and I was working at several universities, the University of Arts in London, the London College of Printing, and Newcastle University, and I'd been working in Italy just before I got the call, and it was a strange step for me, because this was totally out of my comfort zone. It wasn't an area that I was familiar with, and I was thinking, well, what am I going to find here? But as life goes, you take a step. You know, I think a friend of mine always said, never turn left, because you don't know where you'll go. And I turned left, and it was amazing.
So what exactly was your brief? What were you told to do? What were you scheduled to do? And how long were you, contracted to be there?
My brief was to teach the staff at UAPBC, which is the state broadcaster in Ukraine. My brief was to teach them to use cameras on their phones to film. The amount of funding that the state broadcaster had at that time, this is 2019, 2020, the funding they had was minimal. They didn't have much in terms of cash. If you like, I'll send you some of the photos of the cameras that we were using, Royfield, and there were wooden blocks used to sort of like keep bits of battery together on the back of sort of like 20-year-old cameras. And it was difficult for them. You could see that, but the creativity was astounding. They were great, and they'd worked out that it was cheaper for journalists to use their own phones than for the broadcaster to upgrade the cameras that they were using. So I helped to facilitate that, train them in basic sort of methods of capturing video, telling stories with smartphones, how best to capture audio, how to work around light. And they took it all in. They swallowed it up and went out and created some great results straight away. The time that I was there was probably every 2 months for about 2 weeks across the year. So I got a good grasp of what was happening out there. I was in Kiev and Vinnytsia in central Ukraine. I was in Lutsk and Lviv in the west, and I was in Kharkiv and Severodonetsk in the east. Severodonetsk was in the Donblast region, which is basically right on the edge of the war zone, that the area that Russia has been fighting to reclaim over the last 5 years.
What was the political temperature like in Ukraine back in the late 2019 and 2020? Zelensky has just been voted in as president, and he's having this anti-corruption campaign. But there was no feeling back then, or was there, that relations with Russia were going to deteriorate so much that potentially the people who you were training were going to be war correspondents?
My good friend who worked out there was the head of news for the regions at UAPBC, Fedir, used to talk about Russia as their crazy neighbours, and they'd have parties and they'd be bashing on their doors and shouting at them in the street, but they didn't really bother them. And that's how he described Ukraine's relationship with Russia. At the time, there was conflict. Let's go back to 2014, and the sitting president at that time was not trusted. He was too close to Russia for a lot of the public, and they really didn't feel he was up to the job. And there was a riot, there were protests in the street. A lot of the protests were based in a square called Maidan Square in Kiev, and a lot of the people would go across the country to go to Maidan Square and protest about what was happening. In the end, the sitting president slipped away and disappeared into Russia, fulfilling a lot of people's thoughts of what he was like and what his ideals were. And then Zelensky was voted in. Many people may know that he was a TV actor, and he was playing a role of a teacher who became the president. And all of a sudden he goes to become a president in real life, and it shocked the whole country. But around the time of him being elected, Russia wanted to take on the Donbass area, which is the two of the eastern regions in Ukraine, and it basically became war. And we forget they've been at war for 3 years, slightly longer than 3 years. And when I went there, I went to a country that was at war.
That conflict, and you're really right to pull me up about this, because obviously, there was the Russian annexation of Crimea in 2014, and then Luhansk and Donetsk. There was, those two regions. Russia sends in ununiformed Russian troops, along with a whole load of gangsters, and fundamentally, those two bits of Ukraine break away. And in 2015, there is the Minsk Agreement and a line of control, and de facto, these are cleaved away from Ukraine. So was there a sense that this conflict, which was always on a slow boil, you're completely right, it had never come to a full stop, that you were going to be training these journalists to be, potentially to be on that front line and to be documenting that war?
The vast majority of the journalists that I was training never saw any violent conflict from caused by Russia, so their lives were quite regular. They were covering stories about health, education, science, government corruption, too much government corruption, unfortunately, and Russia figured in it, but not massively. But the TV stations in the east, because they're in an area that was occupied, they covered war-related stories regularly. For one example, the Russian church was quite active in Ukraine, and a lot of people put their faith above their national perspective. So because the church was in Russia, they'd support the Russian church and not support the Ukrainian state. And there were arguments and protests about the church in the Donbass area, in the Donbass region. And it was the Russian church the power was taken away from the church. And a lot of people got very upset about it. And these were some of the reports that were being covered. So it's not always directly about conflict. It was about the impact of war that we were seeing. And lots of the journalists that I was working with in that area were covering those types of stories. It was quite worrying, because you talk to them about what they've seen or what they've done. And they take out their equipment, they show you their camera, they show you the microphones, they show you the leads, they show you their flak jacket, they show you their boots, they show you their bulletproof helmet. And things like that bring home the idea that, they're not going into a city, they're not going into a town, they're not covering rural affairs, they're going into a war zone. And that stopped me in my tracks straight away.
Tell us what it was like for you to be traveling around Ukraine. One of the things which is really marked at the start of the Russian invasion was the flood of black and brown people leaving Ukraine, saying that they had problems leaving Ukraine. The UN even made note of this, and it was a footnote to the early news reports that African students, Indian students, experienced racism on the border trying to get out of Ukraine into Poland. I'm guessing that there weren't too many black and brown people in Ukraine. Maybe I'm wrong, but also just tell me how you were perceived being a black Englishman working in this country in Eastern Europe.
Okay, well, I think the first thing I need to explain to you is something called the nod. Do you know what I'm talking about, Royfield?
I absolutely do know what the nod is, Errol. Of course I know what the nod is.
What, will you tell me what the nod is?
Well, when you're in an environment where there's nobody else of colour, and then when you see a person of colour, you both look at each other and give each other half a nod. You don't even have to say anything to each other, but you both acknowledge that you're both in an environment where there is nobody else that looks like you.
100%. And in most of the, not in the East where there was conflict, but in the West and in the central areas, I came across only a handful of black people, non-white people. But every time you see them, you think, my gosh, it's another black guy. It's another black guy. There's two of us in the whole of the city. And you catch his eye and you nod and you say, without words, you're saying, how you doing? I hope you're okay. I've got your back, brother. And you just make a connection because there are so few of us in places like that, or, you know, within cities, within America, within the UK. You might be in an environment where you don't see other black people. And that could be a boardroom, Royfield. And you just connect. You just give a nod to say, I see you there. And I acknowledge that you're there. And I'm glad that you're there. And I hope you're well. And there's a whole conversation in the tilt of a head. And sometimes you wonder, you know, how these things translate. And I was in, Lviv, and there were a couple of black guys in a bar, and I saw them from the other side of the bar, and I made my way round to where they were sitting, but not to sit with them, and just gave them a nod, just tipped your head, and they put their hand up and said, how are you doing? And all of a sudden we have a conversation. And that happened several times in my time in Ukraine. They were all students. The students who'd moved from African states to study, to learn, to work, and to return to their homes. They were pleased to be there. They had opportunities in Ukraine that they hadn't been able to get elsewhere. So it was definitely worthwhile gaining their education there. There were language barriers, but like anything with younger people, sort of like, you know, from 20 to 30, picking up language is about being social. And the more social they are, the more they gain the language, and they're able to translate their experience into the local experience in Ukraine. They did tell me about racism. There were challenges. It does exist. They were feeling that they were treated as different. They weren't given equal status. But they did integrate, and they met Ukrainian women, and they had families, and they were still studying, and they were looking at ways of, you know, going back to their home countries with their new families. And I think that once you have This is difficult to explain to some people, but once you have a white state, anyone who is not white is seen as different, dangerous, not like us. That's probably the easiest way of framing it. And that doesn't exist in black states. You could be in an African country and a white person can be there. And it's like, oh, there's a white guy. But if you're in white countries, specifically European, and there's a black person there, it is sort of like, who's that guy? What's he doing there? And there are lots of question marks put over their heads. And I think that's what they felt. There's a line that says, you don't get, as a black person, you don't get, you get second looks, but you don't get second chances. And that's the sort of thing that I think the students that I met were telling me. They felt different. They felt that they weren't accepted. And because there were so few of them across the whole state, across the whole country, because there were so few of them, they were seen as other. They weren't seen as part of the country, and that was difficult for a lot of people. So, when people's backs are against the wall, people are trying to leave the country. People are looking for ways to get into Poland, into Belarus, wherever they're going, or Moldova, I think. They may not be treated as equally as other people, and that's so disappointing. That's so scary at a time of war.
Give us a sense of how your time was actually structured when you were there. Just reiterate the length of time that you were there and the various trips that you took. Obviously, you worked with and for the Ukrainian state broadcaster. But you know, were you, tell exactly, break down for us exactly how that worked. Were you assigned a team of journalists? So did you go, when you went out into the field, to give us that whole wide sense?
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So I worked with... The idea was that the state broadcaster UAPBC didn't have the funds to get the equipment that they needed to adequately reflect the news of the day, so a decision had been made for journalists to be either supplied with phones or use their own phones to news gather, and that includes the camera crews as well. And my role was to train the journalists to tell stories with their mobile phones. And it worked. It worked. I've seen the work that they've done. I'm seeing the work that they're doing. And it's come across as a way of being able to cheaply and effectively reflect the news. They were very creative already. When life gives you lemons, you make the best lemonade you can, and they were definitely doing that. And I worked with a couple of journalists every day, going out covering stories, and when we came back, we'd talk about what they'd done, how they'd done it, different tips on how to do it. You can't teach people in the field. You have to let them do what they're going to do. It's not like you're going to you're on someone's shoulder all the time while they're filming. It's unnecessary and it doesn't gain good results. So you let them do what they're going to do, and then afterwards you sit down and say, well, look how you've done that. Are there any other ways of doing this? And that's how you can maintain their confidence, maintain their trust, and also give them new tools to go out and film. And that worked. We also did lots of class work, lots of workshops in the newsroom. Everything was through interpreters. Although the majority of the news teams spoke English, sometimes you needed to translate certain ideas or concepts, and you needed a translator for that. So we always had someone to work through, as opposed to working directly with. But as you can imagine, at the end of the working day, we're all being in the bar, and the conversation was 100% English, which is uncanny for me. So there's a lot to learn. There's a lot for me to take on board in terms of their culture, their ideals, and how they work as well. There were challenges there too.
And how do you kind of quantify your success? You know, when the BBC sends you out to Ukraine and says, train people up, you know, with social media techniques, you know, how do they quantify success? How do they know that they've sent out not only the right person, but actually that people have actually been trained and walked away with valuable skills?
How do they know they sent the right person? How can I answer a question like that? How can I answer a question like that? Royfield, it's me. You know,
Errol.
It's a challenge.
You were a trainer of some recruits in the BBC, but you know, I threw that in just as a little gentle.
No. It's a fair question, and I'm joshing with you, Royfield. We go back far enough to be able to do that. If I was in the UK, or in other regions. The gauge that would be used would be how many more news reports are being made using smartphones. And it was exactly the same in Ukraine. And that figure, the figure doubled straight away. That didn't take a lot of work. It was about then building a level of smartphone films compared to the regular camera crew films. That took a little longer, that took years, but the number of smartphone-based news reports doubled in weeks. I think it was just a confidence boost for the journalists and for the editors, the editorial teams, to be able to say, oh, actually, we can do it like this. We will do it. Let's give it a go. Let's see how this works. And there's also the other side of it, which is not doing direct news reports, but the TV stations were online as well as on terrestrial TV. And we were able to do lots of Facebook Lives. We're lots to do short interviews. We're not able to do lots of teasers. We worked with the radio teams and turned interviews into video for the radio, and then reflected that back onto their websites. And that allowed loads of smartphone-based material to be edited on smartphones, edited on computers, and then uploaded to social media. So we were able to get a lot of material out quite quickly and change the dynamic of how the material was seen online. Unfortunately, the majority of phones are HD. Literally all modern mobile phones are HD or 4K, and they were broadcasting in the old standard of TV. So everything looked a little bit grainy, unless you were watching it online. So TV on your sort of like granny's TV at home in the 80s is what normal TV looked like. Whereas if you went online, a lot of these smartphone reports would bring it up to, you know, modern standards of video, which was brilliant.
You obviously will have made some real kind of long-lasting relationships with your students, people who were out there in the field. And you really brought it home for me when you said that, you know, they were coming back, you know, wearing helmets and flak jackets, especially when they're in the east, when they're around Kharkiv, because that was an active and a war zone. Have you been able to maintain any of those relationships, and how are they getting on, if you have?
I've been talking to, I'll just use first names. I've been talking to a former colleague of mine, Serge, who was a reporter in Severodonetsk for UAPBC. And he sent me photos of the area where he was working, the TV station. He sent me video of it, where we'd been. The TV station was gone. The TV station was leveled. So Severodonetsk is pretty much leveled. The hotel where we stayed, the corner shop next to the hotel where we stayed is still there. So that's where we'd get our bread for our breakfast in the morning. The hotel's gone. I don't mean that it's been hit. It's gone. It's disappeared. It's just rubble. And seeing these sorts of things, it's quite upsetting. It's it means that all the messages that I send to him are stay safe, take care of yourself. And at first, Serge, this is probably February, he was staying in bunkers, staying in basements, preparing reports and going out, reflecting the news, capturing with camera crews. And if they couldn't gain access to a certain area, they would use smartphones. That's not always the best way to use smartphones, because if you don't have access, you don't have access. It can create all sorts of dangers. So it still means that, you know, you're not able to protect yourself. Just because you've got a small phone doesn't mean you're not going to attract attention. You could still attract attention. And he stopped working because the station he was working at was closed down, and he didn't want to move. His family are in the area. His friends live in the area. He left Severodonetsk, but he stayed quite local. And I was talking to him. I said, well, what do you want to do? What are you doing? He said, I'm now helping people. I'm going around taking food parcels, giving people aid, working in humanitarian projects, supplying necessary materials to people. And he said that he wanted to get back into journalism, and I told him that I would help him. And I helped him to get some equipment so that he could, don't forget, he hasn't got his equipment because he hasn't got his favorite suit, because he hasn't got his shirts that he would wear every day, because he hasn't got his photo album of his wedding, because when they were told they've got to go, they just up and left with whatever they were wearing, whatever they were carrying, and there was no opportunity to turn back. So I helped him to get some more equipment, and he's told me that he's back at work. So he's filming and he's editing and he's supplying material to as a freelancer in the area now. It's great to know that these things happen, but it's also a reminder that when people say you've got to go, it's not like, well, let me get my camera, let me get my favorite shoes, let me get the photo of my parents who I've lost. You've just got to go. And that's how he had to leave Severodonetsk, and it meant that he lost all of his equipment as well. But I've been able to help him, and I've been able to direct resources to him so that he can get back on his feet and get out there and do what he feels he needs to do.
It's a very powerful human story. We're here speaking to a friend of mine, Errol Murray, from the UK, who went out 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, to Ukraine as part of a BBC program to train Ukrainian journalists in how to use their phones as a way of collating and reporting on Ukrainian news. And Errol has seen the fruits of his labor in no small part, because through this war, through this unjustified conflict, I think one of the most powerful ways that Ukraine has got its message out is by, whether it's by its soldiers or by its journalists, using their smartphones as a way to document the Russian aggression. If you're in the audience, please raise your hand. You can come up and ask Errol a question. You can ask him about his time in Ukraine, and maybe ask him a question about some of the things which he's seen, saw, and reflected upon, considering now what exactly has happened. And I think very powerfully there, Errol, you told us that, you know, the hotel where you stayed in that town, that hotel is no longer there, but the little corner shop still is, you know. So it's, it really kind of brings home to us, you know, the plight and the destruction that Ukraine is going through at the moment. Give us some kind of positive reflections of your time in Ukraine. You know, were there some ways in which maybe your expectations were subverted? You know, you very honestly said, you know, you couldn't even have found the place on a map before you went there, but you went there for the best part of a year, backwards and forwards, in totality, and you got to see so much of the country. Tell us about some of those reflections, which aren't necessarily to do with your job, and give us the kind of the feel of Ukraine and its people.
I think that the first thing that hit me was, the first thing that struck me was a sense of national pride, how much they loved their country, how much they believed in what it was to be Ukrainian. And I didn't quite understand that at the start, and I confused that to be nationalism, which is a very dangerous thing, because that could be where one country puts themselves over another country, as opposed to one country saying they feel that they are, that their country is an amazing country. And it took me a little while, took me a couple of visits to understand that perspective, to understand that they weren't putting themselves over another country. It's because they've had, Ukraine's had such an awful history, a terrible history of famine, starvation, the way they've been treated by Russia. I think there was a famine in the early 1920s where Russia literally took all of the food, the grain out of the country and tried to starve them into a submission under Russian, not just Russian rule, but taking Russian values. And that created a depth of resolution that I think we're seeing in the war right now, where they just dug their heels in and said, whatever happens, we're Ukrainian and we're here to stay and we love our country. And I'm talking about something from 100 years ago that is absolutely apparent right now. And once I understood that, I was able to relate much more directly to them. And it was heartwarming to see that. I'm feeling it now just thinking about it, because it was, there are people who have been, where families have been torn apart now. And the people I was working with, the women and children have been sent to safety in Germany or in Poland, and their partners, the men, are staying to either fight. They're involved in logistics, getting food around the country, getting equipment, supplies around the country. Or they were the people I was working with, and they're continuing to do their job, which is to report and reflect the news of the day. So that heart, to be able to see that and understand that, was an amazing thing. Also, I think the first time I went out was just before Christmas, and basically, if you are Santa at Christmas, you're worshipped. You're like a rock star, and it's like you know, if you went to a kindergarten in a red suit with a big white beard. Royfield, the children are going to love seeing you. So there's a tradition where you people dress up, wear a Santa outfit, and just go from bar to bar to bar. And any bar that sees you dressed up as Santa at Christmas will give you a free drink. So you go from the next bar to the next bar to the next bar. And within an hour or so, you know, people are on their knees. Vodka's a currency in Ukraine, and there's a lot of spending. There's a heck of a lot of spending. So it was great to pick up on the warmth and the happiness that they were able to share over Christmas. That was lovely. That was probably my first and deepest experience of Ukraine. But what stays with me even now is their culture and their love, absolute love of their mother state.
Very powerfully said. Pavel, you were the first person in the room before even Errol got in. So if you've got a question, Pavel, now is your time, sir.
Hello, Errol. Great to have you here. Thank you for joining us on Clubhouse. While you were there, did you take any interest in the structure of the local media market and the role of the public broadcaster? This may no longer seem relevant as all the media are in the emergency mode, but I'm curious if that was brought to your attention.
Yes, I was aware. There were a lot, as in Europe, as in the UK, there were a lot of very rich Russians who have recognised that to improve how they improve their standing. It pays to get a newspaper, a magazine, a radio station, a TV network. And there were several TV stations that were owned by Russians, oligarchs, and they were slick. They looked great. They were fast. They had great equipment, and they had all the ideas. They had the overseas programs as well. And then when you put the news into the mix, it's a very attractive proposition. And the state broadcaster didn't have that money, really didn't have that money. So it always looked, although they were able to present themselves very well, it always looked like the sort of like it wasn't the best. There were other people making TV who made it look really good. And they had money, and the majority of the time that money was coming from Russia. So that means that the influences, the stories, the style of the news was coming from a Moscow-based perspective. And that's a problem. That was a real problem.
Do you plan to go back? You know, you've obviously formed a real attachment with the country, and obviously you have colleagues there. You know, when the conflict's over, do you plan to go back? And could you possibly go back as, you know, as a follow-up to the scheme which took you there?
I've been in touch with the Media Action, which is the organisation that took me there. I've told them that I would like to return, and they said that whatever happens, there will be a return project. So I hope that to be part of that in the future. Right now, it's totally irrelevant. It's difficult to talk about it because the people who I was working with, some of them are still active. Some of them are driving trucks. Some of them are fighting for their lives. Some of them have had to leave the country. It's difficult to understand what the future could be, how the future can turn out. I had a couple of ideas as to what would happen at the start of the conflict, before the conflict. Now I have no idea what's going to happen. So I'm just holding on and offering words of support to my former colleagues, supporting however I can through the charities that exist, and staying in touch. That's all I can do right now. My friend, one of my friends, I asked him if he needed anything, if there's anything I could do, if there's anything I could offer to him. And he said, pray, just pray for us.
The Ukrainian people have your prayers and the prayers of the rest of the world. This is very beautifully said. Guta, you're going to be the last person who's going to throw a question to Errol. So the time is yours, Guta.
All right. Hello, everybody. Well, hi, Errol. And I have a question. And Reufeld, I hope you don't mind, but I'm going to shift from journalism, cameras, and Ukraine to Errol as a dad. Right? I actually saw that you were the founder of Leeds Dad Support Group. And yeah,
Guta, you've busted me.
Of course. I mean, we know how to do our homework, right? And that's, I find fascinating because, especially being part of feminist groups where there are a lot of debates, and I have colleagues that one of the mottos is if you don't have a womb, you don't have the right to be on stage. So I wonder, with a dad like you who does that, tell me what motivated you, how it it's an amazing movement because we don't see that much. And so how it works, what drove you to be this super feminist daddy?
Where are you, please, Gutha?
I'm actually at the moment in Dublin, Ireland.
Oh, wow. Is that where you're from? Was that where you're based? Or
at the moment, yes, that's where I'm based.
Okay. I'm just trying to get an idea of what...
Originally, I'm Brazilian.
Okay. And what's the role of a father in a Brazilian family?
Well, it's the typical, you know, the patriarch thing, sitting the head of the table, going to work, and then seeing the children ready to go to bed when they arrive in time for bed, right? Not going to school plays, not going to sport competitions. So it's changing a little, but, you know, but I was very curious because it's also a debate until when, you know, we would have to share involvement of the other 50% or not.
Sure. I live in a city called Leeds, which is in the north of England, and I my wife and I moved up from London to have a family, and we found ourselves miles, hours from family, and we've built up some great friends, we have some great people around us, but we didn't have family. And when you have a baby, you do need people who you can call at the drop of a hat. And it's like, I'm tired now, I need you now, I don't want you to come tomorrow, and I don't want you to come tonight, I need you now, because I'm going to fall asleep and I'm going to need someone to feed the baby or collect the child from nursery. Does that make sense, Gutha? Do you recognize that?
Totally, totally, totally.
And because we didn't have those connections, which many people don't, because our connections, our lifestyle in 21st century Britain, at least, is quite transient. People move for work, people move to study, people put down roots in different cities quite easily, and then all of a sudden, oh, we've been here 10, 15 years, this is our new home. And I went into the newsroom at the BBC where I was working at the time, and I went to all the mums, because mums make things happen. Mums make things happen, man. And I said, look, do any of your partners want to meet me? And let's talk about being a dad. And I got, I think, three dads. Is there any way I can share photos with you, Royfield? Maybe not right now, but I can send a couple to you. And I got about three dads who joined me, and we talked about how tired we were. We talked about how little we talked to our partners, to our wives, because we were exhausted, and all conversations were about, did you get the nappies? I got the nappies. Did you get the milk? We need a pint of milk for breakfast. I've got a pint of milk for breakfast. And that's the exhausted voices of two people who barely connect. And the poos, we talked about the size of our kids' poops. They were these tiny little things that, you know, babies of, you know, hardly as long as your forearm, and there's truckloads of poop coming out. We called them poonamis. And it was fun, but it was exhausting. And I said, but we enjoyed the conversation. And I said, should we do this again next month? And they said, yeah. Fast forward 10, 11 years. My daughter is now 11 and standing up, looking me eye to eye, almost at the same height as myself. Kids grow so fast. The groups are still running. We meet weekly. We get 20 to 30 dads at each session. We have play groups, we have meetups, we have dads and kids walks, we have Christmas parties, we have Father's Day festivals, We have, because over the last year or two, people haven't been happy to go indoors. We went outdoors. We had forest schools. And the amount of dads who, gosh, they just came out of the woodwork, brought their kids and joined us in play. Socially distanced at that time. Now that distancing has relaxed a little, but we still have to be careful. And when people say, oh, this is for dads, isn't it? I say, well, it is for dads, because dads aren't as socially aware in terms of reaching out for help, reaching out for support, whereas mums have generally a bit more of a natural knack of connecting to other mums. Two mums can be at in a playground, at a play area with their children, see the children get on, so and set up two play dates in 10 minutes. Two dads can be there, and over an hour they might sort of grunt at each other. It's a stereotype, it's a massive stereotype, but I'm afraid there's so much that's real within that. So we wanted to find a way to facilitate making it easier for dads to connect. We focused on something called the First 1,000 Days concept, where lots of organisations, specifically in the UK, the National Childbirth Trust, have said that that's those first 1,000 days, those first sort of like three and a half years, that's the core period of time to bond between a parent and a child. And that's what we focus on achieving. Leeds Dads is supportive of children preschool. Once they're at school, I think that the activities that we do might bore them, but we do focus on the first thousand days, sort of like the first three to five years. And it works. It's definitely worthwhile. I talked about what I was doing when I went to Ukraine. They filmed and interviewed me, so hopefully they've got some reports out on what I was doing, because we stayed in touch over the years, and they asked me to tell them what they were doing. And I talked to teachers when I was out there about the organisation that I run, Leeds Dads, and the children were talking about their own experiences of home. There is a very strong sense of fathers must be hands-on in Ukraine, which I found really heartwarming. There's still a slowness, though, of dads to connect with other dads, to build networks. Maybe rather than go back and help people to film, I might go back and set up some dads groups. That might be a more interesting thing. What do you think?
I find it fascinating, because I think your daddy's group, beside the bond with the child, that it must be completely different than the average dad model, you are actually, you know, adding to the change. You are smashing patriarchy as well on the core of it as a guy, because you guys also have a lot of pressure from that model. Yeah. So congrats. I was like, wow, beautiful.
It's hard to be a dad. It's hard to be a man, because the pressures that are put on us to be sort of like the breadwinners, the strong ones, the one that doesn't cry, it's difficult. And we do cry, and we do hurt. And it's difficult to feel pain and to show pain in an environment, in a world that doesn't accept that model. So thanks for recognizing that. And you know, mums are brilliant. We love mums. Leeds Dads loves mums. You know, Leeds Dads wouldn't exist without mums. If my wife hadn't said, yeah, do it, we wouldn't be running this organisation 11 years later. So thanks, mums.
Well said, sir. Errol Murray, not only are you a good friend, you're obviously a most expert trainer, so much so that the BBC asked you to travel from England to Ukraine over the period of a year to train Ukrainian journalists up. And that has been incredibly timely considering the catastrophe which has befallen the country. And apart from that, you're more than just a decent bloke and obviously a great dad. That has been maybe a little bit more intimate mid-Atlantic, where I spoke to my friend Errol Murray about his time in Ukraine, training Ukrainian journalists. We will go back to more standard programming later on this week. But what we're going to do, instead of doing another deep dive into the Ukrainian crisis, we're actually going to look at how different countries around the world, how they're pivoting and how they're reacting to some of the fissures which have come out of the Ukrainian conflict. So please look out for that. If I could ask you, dear listener, please, if you really appreciate the content here on Mid-Atlantic, go onto a podcatcher of your choice. Anyone will do, but preferably Apple Podcasts, and write us a 5-star review. But also, don't just hit 5 stars. Also write something as well, because that's incredibly important. It's incredibly important for the show because it means that more people will then get to know about Mid-Atlantic. Mid-Atlantic, what we try and do here is to foster conversations, great debate. Yes, we are left of center, but we don't demonize our right-leaning brothers and sisters. We just try and win them over with the strength of our argument. You can write me an email at royfield@gmail.com. Love getting your emails and your feedback, whether it's positive or negative. Send it to me. Even the negative ones, I turn it around to be a positive. I'm always the Buddhist. I try and learn from that. So if you've got some constructive criticism, you can email me at royfield@gmail.com. And that's been just about it. So thank you, Errol Murray. Thank you, Guta Hegarty. Thank you, Pavel, for your questions. And also thank you to the audience who've listened to this kind of intimate tale of Errol Murray in Ukraine. And just the last thing I'll say before we
go, I just want to say it's an honor to speak to you like this. I'm really pleased and grateful that you've that you've welcomed me onto the show, Royfield. And I need to remind people who don't know, Royfield is London royalty. Royfield is West London magic. There are places that he can't walk down the street without being mobbed. So please be aware that you have an amazing host within this room. Thank you.
You know, it's always tricky to make a black person blush, Errol, but you managed to do that. So well done. Thanks for that, pal. Thanks for that. There you go. That's been a slightly more intimate Mid-Atlantic. Take care. Look after yourselves. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.